Here's a quote from the report's introduction. Due to the nature of occupational fraud, each of the estimated 3.55 billion members of the global workforce has the potential to engage in this crime as their employers entrust them with the organizational cash and assets in the ordinary course of business. Although only a small fraction of the workforce will ever commit occupational fraud, myriad factors provide the pressures, opportunities, and rationalizations that motivate and enable perpetrators to carry out their fraud schemes. These circumstances create the conditions for global fraud losses to reach trillions of dollars annually.
It's like the most complicated, nerdiest game of Clue ever. Trillions of dollars are missing, and there are only 3.55 billion suspects. I know, it's the accountant in the server closet with a cash billing scheme.
If you'd like to earn CPE credit for listening to this episode, visit earmarkcpe.com. Download the app, take a short quiz, and get your CPE certificate. Continuing education has never been so easy. And now, on to the episode.
This is Oh My Fraud, a true crime podcast where our stories involve moral decay rather than bodily decay. I'm Caleb Newquist.
And I'm Greg Kite.
Oh, Greg, it's lovely to be back with you.
It is. I'll tell you what, I'm so excited to be here. 9 days out of total hip replacement surgery. This is the dream, man. I got a nice opioid haze going on. This is arguably going to be the best podcast we've ever recorded.
Outstanding. All right. So then let's get you doped up with a listener review. What do you say?
Oh, I love it. Yes. I'm so on board for a listener review.
Okay. Here we go. Apple Podcast username Niche says, quote, "I'm not here for the CPE, but I'm absolutely here for the moral decay and none of the bodily decay. Nonviolent true crime is my jam. 5 stars.
Nice. I love it. Thank you. Niche. Did you call him or her Niche?
I did.
I'm saying it's Niche. But thanks, Niche, for the review. You're the first time we got a listener review twofer where we got to use you in the intro and as the review. You wrote our intro for us. So
yeah.
And I know you and I have a feeling that Niche knew that they knew what they were doing. They teed that up nicely.
Indeed. If nonviolent true crime is also your jam, we'd love for you to leave us a review. And who knows, we might just read yours on an upcoming episode, but probably just once.
Yeah. And if amazing keynote speakers are your jam, or if kick-ass in-house continuing education is your jam, we do that. And who knows, we might even work clean.
We know that. We're pros.
We do. We are.
Yeah. If you need us to work clean, we will work clean. For more info on pricing and availability, shoot us an email at ohmyfraud@earmarkcpe.com.
Cool. Now, Caleb, changing gears.
Yes.
My understanding from, I believe it was just our very last episode, is that as a child, you had dreams of becoming a professional baseball player. That is correct, right?
Yes. Yes, I did. I had these foolish dreams. Yes.
Well, so here's the question. Were you one of those baseball fans who was like super into stats? Like, did you know your favorite player's stats?
Yep. At least I used to be.
Okay.
Yeah.
You used to.
I mean, I guess I was into stats. I think, you know, my peak interest in sports was probably like late 80s, early 90s. And so that's when SportsCenter was becoming very popular on ESPN.
Oh, yeah.
And they reported on that stuff every single day, right? And so I watched SportsCenter every day. And I guess I knew some of those player stats, even the guys that I really liked. But yeah. I don't remember knowing all that stuff.
So you didn't actively like track down stats. You were force-fed them by the media machine.
Totally. That's okay. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Me personally, never a stats guy. The one time that I create, this is the stupidest story. Have you ever heard of the game? It's this dumb game. I don't even know what type of game you would call it. It's this little, yeah. it's called Pass the Pigs. Have you ever heard of it? Of course you haven't. I'm sure there's one listener who's heard of Pass the Pigs.
I have totally heard of Pass the Pigs. What? Please don't. Okay. Don't condescend. Yes, I have heard of Pass the Pigs. Yes.
Have you played Pass the Pigs?
Yes, I believe I have played it maybe a few times. Okay. I just remember that the pig are like dice, and yeah. it's kind of like Yahtzee in a way. But there's not like six dice. There's only like two.
The dice are pigs.
And how the pigs kind of like fall and how they fall onto the table. That's how you score points or something.
That's it. Yeah. So you got these two little like rubberized pig figurines. You roll them, and like depending on how they land, like if they're both standing, I think that's called a double trotter, and you get certain number of points for getting that. But it's one of those games where you can keep rolling the pigs as many times as you want, but you have to voluntarily stop before you pig out. And if I'm remembering correctly, pigging out is when both pigs land on their backs with their four legs sticking straight up in the air. I'm pretty sure that's a pig out.
This all sounds familiar. Yeah.
So it's one of those things where it's like, in theory, statistically, and this is where I got sucked in. Statistically, you should be able to throw those pigs because it was like the first one to get to 100 points or 200 points or something like that wins. Okay. And so in theory, I kept thinking, it's like, am I not winning just because I don't have enough bravery and I should just keep chucking these pigs? And I was like hell-bent on figuring out what the likelihood, like in any given game, how many rounds there typically are until someone hits that 100 points mark or whatever it is. Yeah. And then trying to figure out what's the likelihood of just getting on a roll and getting 100 points in one turn. And because I'm like, okay, so if you figure that out, that it's more likely that you can just keep rolling and rolling and rolling to win before the average number of turns for people who are being wussies and just chickening out. So do you see what I'm saying? So I took copious statistics of like how many rolls until you will pig out, like just, and it's just empirical. It's all just empirical data where you just have to roll and roll and roll to get. So like where I'm rolling, listen, I'm a fucking college student. I'm earning a college degree. And in my spare time, I'm not playing Pass the Pigs. I'm just rolling these fucking pigs until I pig out. And I'm doing it over and over again. I'm spending hours of my life devoted to tracking this down until finally I was like, what the hell am I doing with my goddamn life? And I hung up the pigs, man. That's when I hung up the pigs. So
wow. Oh man. Okay. So even though neither of us have been big on keeping stats or caring about them, the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners is huge on taking stats. And every 2 years, the ACFE publishes its report to the nations on occupational fraud and abuse. The 2024 report just dropped. And on today's show, we are going to dig into it. This is the 13th edition of the ACFE's Report to the Nations. The first one came out in 1996.
Greg, 1996?
Yes, 1996. You may have still been a Christian then, if I remember right.
Let me do the math. Yes.
Alrighty.
Yes, you are
so,
correct, sir.
Christian Greg, were you reading that first edition?
What no. Is the,
no. No, okay.
No.
Gotcha. All right. So how long have you been actually reading it?
It's funny. I went back through my Google Drive because every year I download the digital copy, and we'll have a link to that in the notes. And I've kept it in my same Google Drive that I've had. And I went back and I found that the oldest copy that I have in there is from 2014, and that sounds about right.
Oh,
as that would be when I first, because that's about the time I started doing presentations on fraud. So it makes sense that's been a key source of material for my fraud presentations for as long as I've been doing fraud presentations.
Right.
So, and I don't remember. So if you think about it, so 2014 to 2024, that's a full decade of reports. But also, if you
it's
really
only
look
five
at
reports,
it,
though.
It's actually six.
Oh, because, it's six. Okay.
Yeah, because we're bookending the decade. So yeah, that's six reports.
There you go.
So a lot of reports. And it's funny because I have locked in a lot of those stats into my brain where I have them out, even though every report they change a little bit, but nothing drastic.
Right.
They're fairly consistent, but it is interesting to see the little waivers in the various things that they look at.
Well then, shall we run down some key findings before we get to our favorite parts of the report?
Hit them up, Caleb Newquist.
Okay. Here's some of the high-level stuff, starting with losses from occupational fraud. The CFEs estimate that organizations lose 5% of revenue to fraud each year. That works out to $5 trillion lost globally. That is an unfathomable amount of money.
Yeah.
Here's how much $5 trillion is. If you had $5 trillion in $100 bills and started stacking them one on top of the other, after 4 hours, you'd give up because the amount of money you've already stacked still wouldn't be enough money to pay someone else to stack the rest of your $5 trillion of $100 bills.
You couldn't tell them, Sawyer, your job of stacking $5 trillion of
no
money.
Way.
No way. You just give up because it's bullshit.
Yeah.
Who would even ask you to do that? That's a weird, weird task.
Yeah.
But I love it when people are like, if you stacked $5 trillion of $100 bills, that would get you from here to Venus, man. You could get all the way to Venus with that much money.
And it's dang. Venus is not a place you want to be. So
not a place I want to be.
It's like, it's literally hell on earth in Venus. You do not want to be on that
Well,
planet.
Not on earth. It's because it's Venus.
Right.
It's
on hell on Venus.
Yeah. It's literally hell on Venus. I do think it's funny. One of the things that's always stuck in my mind, because that stat has not changed the part of that stat that hasn't changed for as long as I've been looking at these reports is the 5%. Of revenue lost to fraud. And every year what I think about, because it takes me back to my days of getting my my accounting degree, getting my MBA, and we would be looking at different businesses and looking at their gross profit margins. And I know there's certain industries where their gross profit margins are not 5%. Like I'm thinking grocery stores. Like, are, you know, that's the go-to for thin margins is grocery stores because it's so competitive. And you're going, okay, if your gross margins are 3%, I hope that obviously that's after you've already taken into account the 5% that you lost to
fraud.
Occupational fraud. And which is crazy. That's what the estimation is for the average business. So likely the business you work for is losing 5% of its revenue to fraud.
Ugh.
Dude,
all right.
I don't think my business is.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's a relief. Yeah,
it Greg. Better not be. I'm the guy in charge of that shit.
Yeah. So, no kidding.
So it shouldn't be losing, be losing 0% to fraud.
Here's a few more stats. Median loss, $145,000. Average loss, $1.7 million. Now,
are you going to talk about which one's the better stat?
Yes, I am. Now, if you did not take statistics or are not statistically inclined, here's a couple of definitions. The median, first, is the number that's in the exact middle of the population. Okay? Yep. And the population is the entire body of data. Okay.
Yeah.
And so that means that 50% of the population is above that point and 50% is below it. Okay. So it's precisely in the middle.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is a very, in this case, it is a very good stat. And I'm going to explain that next. Remember, the average is 1.7 million. Oh,
yes.
That seems like a lot, right?
That's way more. Yeah. And it's
that's
crazy.
Way more than $145,000, right?
Because usually your median and your average are not that far off.
These
right. are ridiculously far off.
Yes. And the reason, Greg Kite, that is so is because they were probably a very small number of very, very, very large frauds.
Right.
Right? Much larger than the median. And that drags that average number way, way up.
Yep.
When in fact, the median is a more representative number of what an actual occupational fraud is.
Yeah.
So does that all make sense?
I think that makes perfect sense to me.
Okay.
So, yep. Yeah. I think well explained.
Okay. And if it still doesn't make any sense, send us an email and then we will make fun of you. Okay. So finally, the average fraud lasts 12 months before it's detected. And remember, the longer a fraud lasts, the higher the losses, right? Makes sense. Remember Rita Crunwell from episode 3? If you've been with us a long time, she stole $53 million over the course of 22 years.
Yeah. If her fraud had only lasted 12 months, she wouldn't have gotten nearly $53 million.
Right.
She would have
much
less than that. And it is funny, again, like I was saying, there's a few of these stats that do vary, not a lot year to year, but that one is actually one that I have seen more variation in, is the average duration of the frauds, because I just looked at the 2022 report to the nation, so just the last one that they published, and that was 18 months. So we do see some variation, but basically the way that this ACFE does this is every 2 years they ask their certified fraud examiners to voluntarily send them data on the different cases that they investigated. So every 2 years they have a different basket of cases that they were working on. So we're going to see a little different. So again, it was funny. That might have been back from the 2014 one. Now that I think about it, it might have been the 2014 data that I was looking at where we saw 18 months. But also, the funny thing was that the median loss was the exact same, $145,000. But that's just a weird coincidence. Usually we see some sort of change in both of those numbers.
Right.
In terms of the types of fraud that the report deals with, this report is specifically, and we even talked about it in the title, it specifically deals with what's called occupational fraud, which means fraud that's committed by individuals against the organizations that employ them. So the ACFE categorizes occupational fraud into three broad categories. The vast majority of the cases that we're looking at are asset misappropriation cases, like 80-something percent of the cases are asset misappropriations. But the funny thing is, asset misappropriation, if you just look at them as a cluster, they have the lowest median loss out of any of the three types of fraud. So it's the most common type of fraud, but it also has the lowest median loss. And asset misappropriation, it's a fancy word basically for embezzlement. If people steal money, if you steal money or if you steal stuff from your employer, that's asset misappropriation. So like the guys who were stealing the Pappy Van Winkle bourbon from the Buffalo Trace distillery, asset misappropriation. Again, Rita Crunwell, she was stealing money from the city of Dixon, Illinois. Asset misappropriation. The second type of occupational fraud is financial statement fraud. We talk a lot about that. That's your Enrons. That's your mini scribes. That's your Halliburtons, allegedly. Financial statement fraud, they have the highest median loss by far, which is why they get a lot of media attention. But they also, just in terms of there's only like, I'm going to say it was in the teens of percentages of cases that were that were financial statement fraud cases. So it's kind of the opposite of asset misappropriation. So asset misappropriation, lots and lots of cases, not that big of losses. Financial statement fraud, not that many cases, but huge losses. That are the biggest losses. And then the third type of occupational fraud is corruption. We're talking about bribes. We're talking about conflicts of interest types of thing. And this one lands right in the middle in terms of frequency and losses. It was funny. And so if you're keeping track, I was saying there was like 80 something percent that was asset misappropriation. In the teens, it was financial statement fraud. I think they said like 48% of frauds had corruption. And if you're an accountant, you're going, wait, that's way more than 100%. And you're absolutely right. And that's because some of these cases involved multiple types of fraud. Like you could have one case that was corruption and asset misappropriation.
Yep.
So that's why the
it comes up to more than 100% on that. And the other thing, just to keep in mind on this, and this is funny thinking back to what we're talking about with grocery stores, is that occupational fraud does not include a lot of types of fraud. Like, for instance, shoplifting, not included in occupational fraud. So if we go back to a grocery store, they have these very thin margins, but they also have to account that 5% of what they earn is going to be lost to their own employees stealing from them. And then they also have customers stealing from them. But a customer stealing from a company, that's not occupational fraud. That's a different kind. So that's not covered here. Ponzi schemes, that's not an occupational fraud because those people are not stealing from their employer. They're stealing from their investors. Tax fraud, not occupational fraud because people are stealing from the government or arguably from the pool of taxpayers in the country. They're not stealing from their employers. It also doesn't include cyber crimes like romance scams, ransomware, because again, those aren't crimes against your employer unless you're catfishing your boss. And then that's just in this gray area. And I don't know if there's any actual cases of that made its way into the ACFE's report to the nation, but we can only hope for future publications.
Future episodes.
Yeah, and future episodes.
Here's some more interesting case results that we'll just share. And Greg, I would like to get your maybe hot take on each of these. Are you ready?
I'm in for it.
Okay.
Here we go.
68% of our perpetrators in the report of the nation, 68% of the perpetrators were terminated, fired.
I hate it.
Jobs.
I hate it. That's my hot take. I hate it because we've already talked about this, because you flip the stat around and it's ridiculous. That means that 32% of perpetrators were not terminated from their fucking job. You stole from your boss and you got to keep your job. Bullshit. I hate it. That's the worst thing I've ever heard in my whole life.
Terrible. Terrible. All right.
Terrible. Although at the same time, we haven't gotten into it because I just don't know about our liability, but there was a fraud that happened at my current employer that I helped bring to light, and the powers that be did not want to fire the guy who had stolen allegedly stolen hundreds of thousands of dollars from the company. So I do have personal experience. Eventually he was forced into retirement, which might be different from being terminated. So it happens. I've seen it.
Okay. 57% of the cases in the report were referred to law enforcement.
Again, flip that around. Well, do we have to flip? We don't have to flip that around. That seems ridiculous.
Just over half. So that means just under half were not referred to law enforcement.
Okay. Yeah. So here's another real life example. So a person who's close to me, who at this person's place of employment, there was a person who misappropriated about $60,000 worth of assets from the company and was just simply very simply and quietly let go, and nothing was made of it at all. But here's my reason why I believe that happened is because it is a nonprofit that accepts large donations from individuals, from community, from governmental entities, that sort of thing. And if you involve law enforcement, that becomes public record, and that becomes something that the Salt Lake Tribune could write an article on, and then all of a sudden, all of your people who are happily giving you large annual donations go, wait, what? These guys aren't keeping track of the money that I'm giving in. It's just walking out the back door. Why do I bother giving money to these people? And then all of a sudden that dries up. So my guess is that for them, that was a very calculated decision that going to law enforcement would be counterproductive to the overall health of their organization, which sucks. But so that person just got to keep 60,000 bucks that they stole and just had to go find another job. So, Caleb, we've mentioned this in past episodes, but historically, many, many frauds are discovered via a tip, aka a whistleblower. And this brand new report to the nations is no different. It cites the statistic that 43% of frauds were detected via tip, which by far is that's like the runaway source for detection for frauds. Number two cited source, I would ask you to guess, but I know you already know the answer. It's internal audit. And yeah. The third most frequent is management review. It is interesting that internal audit is, because I think that's the second most with 14%.
Yes,
were discovered through internal audit, and so it's a pretty big jump from 43% coming from tips down to 14% for internal audit. But it also makes you go, those internal auditors, man, they're earning their money by doing what they're doing.
Yeah,
but the other thing is, you work at your day job is a much larger organization than mine. Do you know, does the company you work for have an internal audit department?
No, not in the way that you would think. Not in the way in the context of this report. Like, okay, there aren't people sniffing around seeing to see if employees are stealing money. We have a lot of risk and compliance folks who are looking for red flags of our customers potentially doing shady business.
Oh, interesting. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I get that. That's where the people who are fraud experts at my company, that's where they focus their efforts.
Okay. Gotcha.
For the most part.
Yeah. Gotcha. So I'm going to say no. There's not an internal, which is, and clearly I've got very small organization I work for. We have a total of 3 employees is all we've got, and none of us are internal auditors. So I'm going to say, in terms of all the companies that are affected by occupational fraud, a very, very small fraction of them have internal auditors. And the fact that 14% of frauds are discovered by them actually shows that if small organizations had the resources to employ internal auditors, I think that might end up outstripping tips as being the most effective means of detection. That's just a guess. A speculation, but I think it's a valid speculation.
There would be some weird, wild extrapolation going on there. But it's not a bad hunch, Greg.
Yeah.
Thanks. That's what I'm saying.
Thanks. Yeah. Here's another stat the spread changes from report to report, but the fun is always there for us, and that is that our favorite detection method to discuss is external auditors. And in this report, external auditors were cited as detecting only 3% of fraud cases, but another category that they list for how frauds are detected is just simply by accident. And 5% of the fraud cases were detected by accident. So if you do the math, what that means is that fraudsters are 2% dumber than external auditors are good at their job. And that's a glaring statistic that somebody's just going to go, Oops, I accidentally put the folder with all my fraud documents on my boss's desk instead of his lunch. That's what happens
right
when it's discovered by accident, and external auditors can't keep up with that.
They cannot. And these are professionals. These are people who are well educated, and the dum-dum that leaves his fraud files on an open copy machine
forgot to pull it off the copy machine. I love that.
Forgot to take it off the copier. That is better at detecting fraud than external auditors.
Exactly. And I mean, I know I'm not wrong, because Sarbanes-Oxley required auditors to brainstorm how fraud might occur at the organization that they're auditing. And even with them trying to just go, maybe an AP clerk is also a wizard and can teleport money out. Right. That's brainstorming.
That's totally here. Brainstorming. Yeah.
That even they aren't catching as much fraud as the AP clerks
magic isn't working properly. Here's another interesting thing that I noticed is that this is actually only the second report where they list a quote automated transaction / data monitoring as a means by which fraud is detected. And so which to me, tell me if you're on board with me. That's AI. They're basically AI.
Yeah, looking I think through, so. Yeah,
some form of AI.
Some kind of technological advancement. Yeah.
Yeah. So like I said, this is only the second report where that's listed, and it's already caught up with external audit. It's just as effective as external audit, and it's brand new on the scene. And I've got to assume. Well, so whether or not what they're currently talking about in this report and the last report is AI stuff, we know that there have been these just massive leaps and bounds in terms of what generative AI can do. And I've got to assume that if you feed one of these generative AI bots a bunch of information on how to spot possible fraud, that they're going to get really good at it. And the nice thing is that the robots can actually look at every single transaction, not just a sample set of the transaction. And I think that there's a lot there that could potentially in the future make some huge changes in the data that we're seeing and in the amount of cases that are getting detected earlier and easier due to technology. So I think that's a pretty exciting thing.
Exciting possibility, isn't it?
Yep. Oh, and hey, since we're bagging on external auditors, another thing that's fun in this this report is that the ACFE data, it really drilled down and showed that not only do external auditors detect a very small percentage of frauds, it also shows that they only detect very obvious frauds. Because remember how at the top of the show, we said that the median loss due to fraud for this report was $145,000. Well, the median loss on frauds detected by external auditors was $227,000. So there, it's like the only cases that they're finding are the ones that are so big you can't not find them. That's an oversimplification.
Right.
And I apologize to the external auditors that listen to that I don't think any still listen. We've offended them consistently.
We've alienated pretty much every external auditor.
Right. For over 50 episodes, we've made them feel unwanted. So any that are still here are either brand new and thanks for listening to one episode or they just don't have any, they're robots and at all, you know, like, they're like, what's that? Sheldon from Big Bang Theory, and they just don't really have human emotion. And they go, yeah, we are bad at that, and they accept it. But also, just in the external auditor's defense, their job isn't to detect fraud, right, Caleb?
Every
engagement letter, it says right there that fraud could be happening, and we're probably not going to find it. So don't expect us to do that part of our job. Yep.
Although, yeah, but I mean, if you go back and listen to our interview with Stephen Thomas, and he explains it very clearly that
it's bullshit.
It's bullshit.
Yeah. And like bullshit and has been determined so in a court of law.
In a court of law.
But here's the last thing I want to talk about in terms of detection. The least common way that fraud is detected, and this is the case, I think, in every single report that I've seen, is by confession, where the person just, their guilty conscience gets the best of them, and they just barge into their boss's office weeping and going, I'm so sorry, I'm such a bad person. I've been stealing $53 million. It's not how Rita Crandwell happened, but it would have. How nice would that have been if just eventually her conscience made her give up everything? I do think it would be more than 1% of frauds detected by confession if companies would start doing what I've said for years, and that's hire an in-house priest so that every Friday you've got fish in the cafeteria, you have a happy hour from 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock, and there's a confession booth in the break room.
I think if they did that, it would only be a couple more iterations of this report before confession surpassed external audit.
All right, Greg Kite. Moving on to perpetrators.
Yes.
A lot of fun stuff in the report to the nations on perpetrators. For example, operations, accounting, sales, customer service, and executive/management are the top five functions for occupational fraud in terms of frequency. So people in those departments committed frauds the most frequently. But
and accounting.
Yeah.
Oh, accounting wasn't the top slot.
It was not. It was operations.
It's usually always accounting in that top slot. Come on.
And actually, sales was tied with accounting in this report.
So oh, my gosh. We have slacked off. Come on. Pick up the pace, accountants. We usually dominate this. Actually, I'm going to say we're probably lower this year than we were 2 years ago, because you know what was not in existence when the last report dropped? The Oh My Fraud podcast.
And oh, yes.
So I'm going to say there is definitely a causation, cause and effect.
There's a strong correlation there.
I think there is. So but, we're probably doing good work in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, frauds committed by the board of directors or by executives in upper management had the biggest losses. I think that makes perfect sense.
By far, though. We're talking both of those groups. The median was like, what, the median for the board was $800,000, and the median for executives and upper management was $793,000. So basically, both of them, $800,000 was about the median loss for both of those. When again, we're talking median loss for all of the frauds.
$145,000.
So
right.
That's where your losses are coming from.
Yeah.
Your big losses.
Your big ones. Yep. Cool. So it comes as no surprise that these are the biggest threats when it comes to fraud.
Yeah. Yeah, because management, they're the ones who can override the controls. They've got the skills to do that. And I mean,
skills or access, power.
Access, power more than skills.
Yeah. Yeah.
But probably a couple skills.
I don't know if skills have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
They're just hammering through the fraud.
Right. Gotcha. Nothing to see here.
Right. Right.
Yep.
On the other hand, who do you think sucks at fraud, Greg?
Who?
Customer service.
Yeah.
Yeah. According to the report, they commit 9% of all frauds. That puts them in the top five, but the median loss is only $55,000, which is like barely enough to even involve a CFE.
Right. Right. Because
like,
that's
you have to think the CFEs on that case were like, oh, come on. this is all I get.
My fees are like a third of what you lost to this fraud. How are you justifying my paycheck for this?
Yeah. It just goes to show that customer service isn't what it used to be.
That's so true.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about internal audit again, shall we?
Please.
According to the data, they commit less than 1% of frauds. So is it that they commit less fraud, or do they just get caught less?
I think that is an interesting question, because again, well, because it's one of those things where we've talked about this on other episodes, where I remember when it was probably in one of my first financial accounting classes where we had a section on fraud, and they started like the professor started explaining different types of fraud, and I was like going, yep. Oh my gosh, that's right, you could totally steal money doing that. I never even thought of that. And all of a sudden, like, I'm learning how to, I mean, obviously you can't know how to detect fraud if you don't know how fraud is perpetrated, but the other thing is you're also learning how to perpetrate fraud. And if anybody's going to know the ins and outs, not just of how to steal money from a company, but also how to specifically steal money from this specific company, it's going to be internal audit. So that said, I'd like to say, I guess going back to your question, do they commit less frauds, or do they just get caught less? I would like to say that my guess is that they just commit less frauds, because their whole job is to make sure that stuff stops. And I think that kind of gets in your blood, where you're like, you know, that a part of your whole self image is, I'm the guy that stops fraud, so I'm not going to be obviously the guy who perpetrates the fraud.
Right. Right.
So you okay. very much have the white cowboy hat.
Very much so.
In your, in, like I said, in your own self image.
All right. Let's play a little game to see who's most likely to commit fraud.
Okay.
Okay.
I love this. I've done this in live fraud presentations before.
Okay.
Because in the report, they like break down like the different, we'll get into it. So you and me, we're going to play this game to see who, between Caleb and Greg, according to the profile of fraudster, who's most likely to commit fraud.
Okay, here we go. You're most likely to commit fraud if, one, you're in the operations department.
Okay, are you in the operations department at your day job?
Okay,
I would say I am not.
Okay.
There could be a case that I am, but I'm going to say that there's other better ways to describe my function at my day job other than operations.
Okay. You're male.
Yes, I'm male.
Yes. Yes,
I identify as male.
And so, I am too. Okay.
Yeah, because men commit
more
the vast
fraud.
Majority of frauds.
Mass. Yep, that's right.
And it is it is interesting because the report breaks it down region by region throughout the world too. And we do see that there's more gender equity in fraud in North America than there is in anywhere else in the world.
Yeah,
so really, we're, you know, I'm going to say that's weird progress. Is that going to be weird?
It's a feather. Yeah. It's a feather in our fraud cap.
There you go. There you go.
All right. You are 36 to 40 years old.
I am not.
Okay. Me neither.
Okay.
However, if you're over 60, which neither of us are.
Nope.
You have the biggest frauds. The median fraud for perpetrators over 60 is $675,000. Whew, boy.
I love that. And that makes me, I don't know why that makes me so happy that grandpa's like stealing all the money. But
right.
It shouldn't. It should make me angry. But
yeah,
it makes
so no early bird dinners for those fraudsters. Those guys are going. Those guys are eating at a decent hour for
right. Right.
Yeah.
7:30 earliest.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
If you're pulling in $675,000 in fraud money.
Okay. Most likely commit fraud if you have a university degree but not a postgraduate degree.
Gotcha. So that would not be me because I have my MBA.
I have a postgraduate degree as well. So that is not me.
So we're tracking. We're neck and neck.
I think we are. I think we each have one each.
Yeah. Which, because we're dudes.
Dudes.
Yeah.
Again, the postgraduate fraudsters have the biggest frauds, though. The ones that do commit them. But because they use, you know, stats and psychology and quantum mechanics to, you know, do all that stuff.
Right. Right.
Yeah, right. Of course. Yeah. All right. You are a manager, not me.
I am. I absolutely am.
Okay. Okay. So you're a manager.
I'm a manager.
Okay. Strike two. Okay. You're most likely to commit fraud if you've been working at your current job for 1 to 5 years. I am beyond 5 years. Great.
You are beyond 5 years. I am also well beyond 5 years. I'm 15 now.
Okay. Wow. Where I'm at. Yeah. Okay. More likely to commit fraud if you have no friends. In other words, most frauds are committed by just one person rather than a group of people. I'm
going to say
I have some friends. I think I'm fine.
Here's the thing. The way I interpret that is like, do I have like ride or die people at work where it's like,
right. Gotcha.
That's how I interpret it. And I go, I got friends. But I don't have like help me bury a body friends.
Yeah. Right.
So
right.
I think to me, I'd have to give myself the point there.
Okay.
Because like I said, the vast majority of these frauds are committed by a solo, just by an individual working alone.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
But again, what another interesting fact is that groups, the biggest takes are from groups of three or more people colluding for the fraud. But then you've got to look at a per capita take, and it's once you start getting, you know, five people involved, is it worth it?
No, because someone's going to squeal.
Someone's going to squeal? Yeah.
Totally.
That's probably true.
Totally.
And your cut's less than if you did it by yourself. So why?
Exactly.
you know, why outsource? That's right. That's so horrible. Like we're now like going, listen, if you're going to do this, don't be a dipshit. that's not really our intent.
No,
it's not. This show.
All right. Finally, you're most likely to commit fraud if you've never been charged or convicted of a fraud. 86% of perpetrators have never been charged or convicted of fraud. That means 14% have been charged or convicted with fraud. And what the hell is that about? I mean,
right.
And 9% of those 14% are working in customer service. But who's giving? Is that right? Do those numbers work?
I mean, customer service is shitty at their at committing fraud. So likely they've been convicted of fraud,
right?
And they're back at right. it. That's yeah, it. I mean, yeah, that's my guess.
That's yeah. your read on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. Yeah. I have never been charged or convicted of fraud. So I actually only, I believe I only check off one out of eight of these, most likely to commit.
You're
fraud.
Clean. You're clean.
Yeah. I think
get out of here.
I think I'm looking good. And yeah. you, how many did you check off?
I checked off three. I'm okay. three. So
still three out of eight's not very many.
It's like I said, I've done this in live fraud sessions before.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I have the whole audience going along and it's awesome. Because you'll have somebody there who's like, I'm 8 out of 8. Nice. It's just like that guy, he'd fire him now. Who's with
him? Watch out for
fire,
that guy.
Fire that guy, right? He shouldn't, don't let him back in your office. So next, Caleb, we're going to talk about red flags. This is probably my favorite thing with fraud.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I don't know why it just perennially excites me, and there's a lot of red flags that they list, so we're going to go through these pretty fast. But also, please, as we burn through these, give commentary as you have it. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Well, and so, let's if you're playing at home.
Oh yeah.
Score.
Let's do this. Yeah. Let's keep track. So the first one, by far, the biggest red flag is living beyond your means. We see that all the time. We saw that with Nathan Mueller. We saw that with, you know, with the wine, the guy fraudulent with the wine.
Oh, Rudy Cornelia one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. We see it. As a matter of fact, it's so prominent that people are living beyond their means. Even, you know, Rita Crunwell, to talk about her again. Is mm-hmm. all these people are living beyond their means. The fruitcake fraud guy was going on private jet trips with his friends, but he still, for some reason, won't let go of his $40,000 a year controller job at a bakery.
Right.
So we see that all the time. That is by far the biggest red flag. Caleb, do you feel like you live beyond your means?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I don't either. I think everything lines up pretty good with me. The second one is financial difficulties. 27% of fraudsters exhibit that behavioral red flag. Makes sense too if you think about the fraud triangle, is that one of those sides of the fraud triangle is pressure. So if you have financial difficulties, that's going to be one of the things that's going to do that, financial difficulties. The third one is unusually close association with a vendor or a customer. So like, do you have like a sister or a brother who's a vendor or a customer for your day job?
No, I do not.
Yeah, I don't either.
Okay.
I don't have any, but again, that's where a lot of like the corruption stuff comes in, is if you have too close, like if the person who is providing your office supplies happens to be your wife, then you might be getting overbilled for office supplies.
Because, sure.
You know, that kind of thing. The next one, control issues, unwillingness to share duties. I hate delegating. So I don't know if I would say I'm a controlling person, but I definitely don't like delegating stuff to other people. So I would say unwilling to share duties. That's a thing. I feel like the way I do it is the way that I like to do it, and the way I feel like it needs to be done. And if I hand it off to somebody else, it's not going to be done the way I like it. So I'm probably going to give myself that one. So I got my next one. We've talked about this one a lot, it feels like, on podcasts. The next one is irritability, suspiciousness, or defensiveness. That's one category.
Yes.
And I go, if I still had a Tinder profile
and I tried to describe myself in three words, it would be irritable, suspicious, and defensive.
Yeah.
So that's so yeah, I'm gonna give myself that one.
Yeah. Three for three.
Yeah. The next one, divorce or family problems. And I have been divorced, but I think the way I read this is like currently going through a divorce.
Right.
That's how I read this. But I also do, and I get what they're saying, like having family problems. But again, I do, just being the nitpicky smartass that I am, I go, so are you saying that it's a red flag if your family has any like what family has no problems? So I guess everybody has this red flag. Smartass isn't a, that's not one of the red flags.
Well, and I'd have to say, if you have family problems, then irritability and defensiveness are like an auto check, right?
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's not even a question. So,
right. Okay. Next one is addiction problems. Are you addicted to anything right now, Caleb?
Maybe Peaky Blinders, but okay. Oh, no. Did that not land? Wrong show.
I mean, my three addictions are Diet Coke, internet porn, and opioids. So I had hip surgery less than 2 weeks ago.
So you're just getting into the opioids.
I'm developing the opioid thing, but the other ones are well established.
Yeah, I gotcha. Okay.
So, but again, I don't know if those are real addictions.
Diet Coke?
Nah. Yeah. Let's see. Complained about inadequate pay.
What, like recently?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Ever. I think that's an ever.
Oh,
but, then, but probably the more recently, the better. The more the redder the flag, the more recent the complaint.
Sure. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. We both got that one. Yeah.
And again, well, I think this would go with irritability and defensiveness.
Exactly. Well, and I like it too, because this is one that you could use, like a company could use against somebody, where it's like, I don't mean to be a pain in the butt, but I was just wondering, it's been a few years since I've gotten a raise, and I was just wondering if, and they'd be like, get the fuck out of here. You're stealing money from our company.
Yeah.
You're fired. Red flag. Let's see. What's the next one? This is a new red flag. This is only the second report they've had. This is excessive internet browsing.
Yes.
And that's a red flag. And I'm going to go, everyone with a smartphone, it browses the internet. What's the opposite of excess? Like you're only browsing the internet enough to survive? What does that mean?
Adequate browsing.
Adequate. So again, if you're only on the internet to order food to be delivered through a food delivery service, then you're good. Other than that, it's excessive, and
even that seems excessive, to be honest.
It does. If you're getting it delivered, I mean, that seems like you're living beyond your means too.
Yes.
But the interesting thing, and I always love to point this out, this year, what did they say in this year's report, it says that 16% of fraudsters exhibit no behavioral red flags. And that seems, it's always seemed ridiculous to me, where I go, how could anyone not exhibit at least one of these red flags? But as you know, we also, what was it, in episode 46, we looked at the municipal tax collector in Maine, Claudia Viles, who was a goddamn saint, but also stole over $500,000 from her city.
Yes.
And that was the thing that kind of blew my mind, is I go, okay, we found a case where she did not exhibit any of the behavioral red flags. So we found one, 16%. I think you just didn't know the person well enough. They exhibited a lot of these red flags. You just weren't tight enough to be able to see all the social isolation or instability in their life circumstances. And listen, there are several other red flags that we did not cover as we were going through this. But again, we got a link to the report in the show notes. Go check it out. You can see the entire list there and peruse it at your leisure.
Okay, Greg, controls. We're going to talk about controls.
Yep.
And their role in not finding fraud,
right?
Or their role in all of this, I suppose, in whatever way.
if there's something we talk about almost every episode, it's controls that we're lacking.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So here we go. First one, 82% of victim organizations modified their anti-fraud controls after the fraud. And why this isn't 100%, I don't have any fucking idea. But
That's a good point.
But nearly 20% just took a look at what happened, took a look at how their business was being run and go, nah, we're
right.
good.
Right. Our house got robbed. Why? I left the front door unlocked. Ah, but I fucking hate carrying a key. So I guess that's just what happens.
Yeah, I guess. Yep. You win some, you lose some. You know,
right.
All right. And one other one just off the top here before we get into some of the other stuff. 27% of modifications are expected to be extremely effective. And I guess I find that odd because it seems low. Like, do you feel like the people that, you know, were they sandbagging?
They're just like, I don't want to say that they're definitely going to work because that means I'm just going to jinx myself and we're going to get fucking ripped off again.
Like, right. it just feels like, wouldn't you try to fix controls or wouldn't you try to implement controls where you're just like, if we do this, no one will ever be able to commit fraud again? Right. Or like, right. just, I don't know, just a little bit better than 27%, I guess, for extremely effective controls. Well,
yeah, I'm right there with you. If some sort of fraud were perpetrated against your company and you discovered it, you would also figure out how they were able to perpetrate the fraud. And then you should be able to plug that hole in yes. your internal controls. And plugging that hole would be extremely effective to prevent that fraud from happening again.
Right.
So yeah, that's kind of weird where it's like, I mean, again, is like, oh my gosh, you know, people were stealing all of this cash from our company because we just left it out on top of our desks. So I guess what we could do is we could have a meeting and tell people, hey, stop stealing all that cash. And then right. well, I don't know if it's going to work, but right. something's better than nothing. Right, guys? That sounds like what happened there.
All right. Now, the most effective anti-fraud controls were present at a small number of the victim organizations. Because there are a lot more small organizations who can't afford to implement controls than there are large organizations that can afford to implement them. In other words, the best controls can only really be afforded by big companies. Is that essentially what that means? That's essentially what that means.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that makes
sense. That's my company. We have very minimal separation of duties at our company because we only have four employees and we got one owner who's kind of fulfills an oversight role. And so the only way to have better internal control, better separation of duties is we'd have to hire someone else just to be able to implement those internal controls.
Right.
So that's, So smaller companies just don't have the resources, whether that's financial or personnel, which again, I guess personnel boils down to financial. That makes sense to me.
Okay. The weakest anti-fraud controls, for example, code of conduct, external audit, were present at nearly all of the organizations. So really high percentage of those organizations had those two things.
Right.
But also, let's be real, external audit is not an internal control. Like that's a weird kind of like classification for something like that.
Right.
So, I mean, it's semantics, but it is definitely annoying that they call it that.
Right.
Yes,
because agreed.
It is, by definition, an external audit.
Yep.
Right. One of the more effective controls is fraud training. It's counterintuitive that people who are trained in fraud will be worse at it. But really, this is very important. It's important that people are explicitly told what purchases on their company expense card would be considered fraud. If a janitorial vendor says that they'll clean your house for free, if you hire them to clean your offices, then that's corruption.
Right. Yeah. And I do think, and it's funny because a lot of this stuff seems, well, I don't know, maybe the janitorial thing doesn't seem so obvious, but it reminds me of my friend who, this was back when I was still a math teacher. She had graduated about the same time I did, and she was an accountant. She got a job at Ernst & Young, and she was in the Seattle branch, and one of her audit clients was REI. I think I've told you the story before.
Yes.
And once I found out about that, I was going, that must be awesome. I bet you they give you some sweet swag for being their auditor. And she was like, so offended. She was like, oh my heavens, no, we cannot accept any gifts from a audit engagement client. And I was like, oh, I didn't mean to, but me, I had no idea that that would somehow be compromising,
right?
But obviously it is, now that I'm where I'm at now. So, but it's stuff like that, that, you know, the different nuance of that, that you do need to train people, because a lot of people just don't understand that you can't, you know, there's certain things that you cannot do at the company. And like, for instance, like our my company, a lot of what we do is we maintain, it's because, so I'm an in-house CPA for a group of medical office buildings. One of the big functions that I do not do is maintenance, but we have like a work truck. And so one of the things that's part of our policy and that we do tell people is it's okay for us as employees to borrow the work truck if we need a truck for the weekend. But there's obviously a lot of companies where it's like, oh yeah, you have keys to the work truck, but you better not be hauling, you know, materials for your shed that you're building on the weekend with that work truck. But people might be like, what are you talking about? I have it. Why wouldn't I, you know? So you do have to train people, or else they're not going to know.
Right. Right. Another weird internal control listed is the existence of an anti-fraud policy. So it's weird because no company has a pro-fraud policy.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Nobody during employee onboarding says, all right, if you don't at least steal a stapler in your first month, then you're not Arthur Anderson material. Nobody's saying that.
Right.
Okay?
Not even back when Arthur Anderson was around, nobody was saying that at Arthur Anderson.
Right.
Yeah.
But really, this is the tone of the top stuff, right? So there's a lot of crossover between anti-fraud policy and fraud training, but the policy side of it is basically stating that the organization has zero tolerance for fraud. Anyone who commits fraud will be fired and prosecuted and booed as they leave the office building or when they're seen in public in the future.
Right. That'd be a great policy, is that we will, when I do see you at Classic Skating roller skating rink, every time I do lap you, I'll just be like, boo.
I'll hiss at you.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, you know, justice. That's justice.
For sure. For sure. And I love this. When asked to identify the main internal control weakness for each of the frauds in the 2024 report to the nations, 32% just said lack of internal controls.
Right. What's the weakness in internal controls? Yeah, we don't have those.
No, we don't have them.
Yeah. Yeah. But
that's the big weakness.
Yeah. But I'm not surprised by that because I mean, how many of these episodes do we just end and go, yeah, of course they were going to steal. There was zero internal controls.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Or they were just, it's like, we have that, but we don't do it.
Right. Right. Exactly. We worked around that. Yeah. We worked our way around those.
Yeah.
That was cute. Right. That was cute what you tried to do there, but we figured a way.
Yeah. But what I love even more is that in 8% of the cases, the main internal control weakness was, quote, tone at the top. But earlier in the report, they're saying that 19% of frauds were perpetrated by owners or executives. So unless I'm misunderstanding this, that means that in 11% of frauds, an owner or executive commits the fraud, but the tone at the top was fine.
Right, right. They are, the tone at the top is the owners and the executives, but they're the ones.
Right.
So yeah,
because the fraud.
It's only saying 8% of frauds had bad tone at the top, but 19% of the frauds were committed by the people at the top. So 11% of your frauds, huh?
Yeah, we have zero tolerance for the frauds that are committed by anyone but us.
Right, right. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's a weird conflict in those stats for sure.
All right, Greg. Did we learn anything?
Yep. Well, that's it for this episode. And remember, if you commit occupational fraud 3 times, statistically, you're only going to get fired twice.
And also remember, external audits aren't designed to detect fraud, but no one gives a shit. Find the fraud.
Do your fucking job. It is your job. But please keep listening to our podcast. And if you want to drop us a line, please send us an email. If you want to send us an angry email about how you're really a champion of everything that is good and right as an external auditor, send us your complaints in email form to ohmyfraud@earmarkcpe.com. And Caleb, where can people find you out there in the wild wilderness that is the internet?
Oh, LinkedIn /? LinkedIn, not /. All the slashes. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn.
Probably Caleb Newquist.
Caleb Newquist, yeah.
Yep. Good.
Greg Kite.
I also on LinkedIn, I am remiss. It's probably been, at least 9 days since I've checked my LinkedIn profile. Something about a hip replacement has not made it something that I've done, which is weird. You'd think I'd have more time for excessive internet browsing with being laid up with a hip replacement, but I have not. But that's probably the best way to find me. Send me a DM on LinkedIn. I'm Greg Kite, CPA. Look for the bald guy with a beard and glasses that says Greg Kite, CPA, and you found me.
Oh My Fraud is written by Greg Kite and myself. Our producer is Zach Frank. Rate, review, and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. If you listen on Earmark, you could get some CPE.
Nice.
That'd be all right.
It's awesome.
Join us next time for more average swindlers and scams from stories that will make you say, oh, my fraud.